Candy Floss News and no political spin. This is Truth Radio by Internet. Thanks to our sponsor, Neemwell.com, because here, the expression is still free. It's full spectrum liberty, the perfect antidote to Donald Rumsfeld. We'll be discussing that with a forum member, and we'll be talking to Dr. Al Sears about how the way you exercise could do you more harm than good. You're on the next level on breakfornews.com.
Would you do me a favor and push me on to the next level?
And you're very welcome. You're on the next level, and this is Fintan Dunn reporting. Thank you for joining us. We'll be speaking later on to Dr. Al Sears, and he's got vital information that you really should know before you're engaging in any kind of an exercise program, because you could be doing yourself more harm than good. He'll be joining us later. But first, we're going to pick up an issue that has been raised in the forum on breakfornews.com, a post there just in the last 24 hours. And I've linked to that on the homepage. And if you want to follow this, you can click on the photo that goes with this audio or click on that link to Full Spectrum Liberty. And Full Spectrum Liberty is an idea that's been posted by Navari on the forum. And hey, I'm going to let him explain some of the background to it for you, because he's standing by right now from the west coast of the USA. Navari, alias Stephen. Hey, you're very welcome to the next level.
Thank you very much for having me, Fintan, and I'd like to say I'm a relative newcomer. I think I've only been on the forum for a few months, and I'm happy I found your little spot on the web, and I think you're doing a fantastic job with what you've done so far.
Okay, well, I tell you what, it's a collective effort now, and there's a lot of great posters on the forum, a lot of great ideas there, and among those great ideas is this one of full spectrum liberty. And it was Donald Rumsfeld gave you the idea. Amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, over the last number of years, quite, you know, 10, 15 years, I've certainly been wrestling with these issues. And what I've learned is that some of my ideas for creating a vision for the future have come from the machine itself. And I tend to look at what the Department of Defense is doing quite frequently and try and look at their strategies. And really what I've learned is, in several instances, I've been able to come up with concepts that flip their strategies on their head and can be used by the masses to the masses' benefit. And that's really where full spectrum liberty came from. Mm-hmm. It came from the issue of full spectrum dominance, where the U.S. military just completely tries to take over an enemy economically, psychologically, militarily, in every way possible. So in looking at that concept, I thought to myself, you know, that's an interesting concept. How can we as the masses leverage this? I mean, really, what are we after here? What are we as individuals after globally? And it's really complete and total freedom. So it was really just a combination of looking at what the Department of Defense is doing and trying to figure out how can we apply that to our own society, and that's really how the term full spectrum liberty kind of came up. And now, you know, I've been looking at how do you define it, and what does it really mean, and how do you create the vision of what society would look like if it was to implement a full spectrum liberty. And by no means am I claiming that I've gotten very far down this road, and that's really why I wanted to throw it out there, sent into the forum, because I've been so impressed with everyone. Your work and everyone that's been on the forum, but let's throw it out there. There's a ton of smart folks out there, and let's start discussing it and see if we can start to come up with our own vision of what society looks like.
Yeah, well,
in 50 or 100 years. Mm-hmm.
Well, I tell you what, you know, you're really plugging in to what we need to get to, I think, because this full spectrum dominance idea is so last century, and this is the way these guys think, and yet we are entering into an egalitarian era, which is characterized by the internet itself. And those guys are trying to box us into a corner. I'd use as an illustration the whole issue of, say, Guantanamo, which is not about detaining prisoners for military benefit, because you could do that much easier. And it's not about gaining intelligence. It's about nothing more than creating a landscape of intimidation in order to psychologically affect us in terms of not resisting these people. And they're using the imagery and associations of, say, Guantanamo and people in manacles and watch out or we'll do this to you too, to box us into a corner. And we've got to break out of that. And that's why this is so completely opposed to that, Stephen.
So let's figure out, okay, so these are some good examples, and I'm just going off the top of my head here. Well, you know, immediately as I hear this imagery of Guantanamo, mm-hmm. I think to myself, okay, how do we flip it on our head? Well, let's start a dialogue about what happens to politicians who authorize that sort of punishment. Let's talk about equal punishment for politicians who are found guilty of that sort of punishment. Let's start to intimidate them. Let's start to invoke fear in politicians for doing something against society. They talked about 1984 brought in the concept of Big Brother. Let's create the anti-1984. Let's talk about how do we, as citizens, oversee our governments. These governments which are supposed to benefit the masses, let's look at putting cameras instead of on the streets of London where there's more cameras than anywhere else in the world. Let's start a dialogue about putting cameras in their home, in politicians' homes, public servants' homes, in their offices, in the bathrooms. Let's flip the psyop. These guys work for us. We want to make sure they protect the public first. That's our money. They're entrusted to it. We own the store. They just happened to come in and operate the cash register for 4 years. And you know what? We're going to watch every damn thing they do. Let's put those sorts of discussions out into the public domain. Let's start introducing that into the mind share of the global population. And let's just start to see what happens. Without those ideas out there, you know, they think they can continue to just run roughshod over us. Well, let's flip it.
Yeah, well, that's a very good starting point, which is proper oversight of the political structures for corruption reasons and also for their use for personal benefit. But touching again on the Guantanamo issue, there are key issues I know will resonate with a lot of people, and they are, speaking personally, I want unqualified habeas corpus rights back and want the Patriot Act out, which is something that I notice is not on the Democratic Party's agenda, despite all the posturing that's going on. So we've got to get full habeas corpus back, and we've got to get rid of legislation like the Patriot Act. That's basic civil liberties defense. We've got to roll back the clock on that. That'd be right up on the list for me.
I would take it a step further, Finn.
Mm-hmm.
I would take it a step further. Let's start talking about, and maybe this is a little excessive here, and maybe I'm doing this just by way of example, but let's talk about removing habeas corpus rights just for politicians. You know, citizens here in the United States of America, that were born in the United States of America, are sovereign individuals. I mean, that's how our system was set up. Each individual is a king in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The government is the one with all the constraints. Let's start increasing the constraints and limitations on government. Citizens aren't the ones, and we're actually really not technically citizens, but we're not the ones that are supposed to have any constraints on that. Let's just flip this entire equation on its head and get people. I mean, the goal here is to get people to start to think for themselves. I think once that occurs, they begin to lose. It's only when this duality system that you talked about so eloquently in your last radio broadcast, you know, it's only when that is effective that this whole system works. As soon as enough people start to break away and think about this, they get the aha moment. Hey, wait a minute. We're the ones with the power here, and we're the ones that's supposed to be able to see them. I think that's when we start to enter the plurality vision that you spoke of. And I think just by getting that out into the public domain will start to breed fear in those currently in control.
Okay. Well, there's definitely one aspect of that, Stephen, I could really resonate with, and that is that it is a life imprisonment offense to engage in the use of federal level or high government level intelligence activities for the control or influencing of domestic political opinion and political expression. Because that's what's one of the reasons we're in this mess we're in, is because intelligence activities have been redirected back at the people. Instead of being for defensive purposes, they're being used internally for domestic political control. And in order to prevent that ever happening again, we have to have a law that you do that and you never see the outside of a cage again, period. Guantanamo would be a good place. We've got to protect ourselves against the use of intelligence agencies to oppress the people.
Okay, how about this? Okay, just, you know, for me, this is just kind of a brainstorming session, you know, kind of just how I might approach something when I'm just thinking about creating a vision. I think it was Gary on the website, someone on the website, it wasn't Gary, turned me on to Thomas Barnett, who's somebody, total establishment, Harvard, PhD, who's going around the Pentagon selling his vision for how the U.S. should go in and take over countries. And I think, if I remember right, Thomas Barnett, he's got a blog, he's got plenty of material out there folks can read, and I've been following him now since I found out about him. I think he's been talking about what he calls open source intelligence. And he's looking at it from the value of having regular folks using sort of the mechanisms of the internet, mm-hmm. so successful in the blogosphere, and trying to adapt those to intelligence gathering. That's a very interesting concept, but I'd like to take it further. You know, intelligence gathering doesn't necessarily need to be centrally controlled. We can decentralize, we can disaggregate. I think we can, given technology and where it's going, we can start taking some of these functions which are critical for them to behave, you know, critical to them supporting the way they behave, and start to disaggregate them. And make them, maybe put them in the public domain. But if we can decentralize some of these critical elements, like intelligence, we can create a situation where it would be very difficult for them to regain control. And so that comes back into sort of my loose definition, which I put on the web, you know, where I basically say that, you know, no elite, no government, no individual can negatively impact it. You create a system that's so decentralized by its nature that it can't be reaggregated again and controlled.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea. And here's one that would complement it, which is to use the idea of citizen participation in police authorities, for example, which happens, where citizens sit on policing boards, that you would have rotating participation by rotating citizens. In other words, these would come out of ordinary people and it would rotate quickly enough so that no individual could become corrupted by the system. So that you have ordinary citizens sitting in at the highest level of these functions, which are necessary security functions that do require a certain degree of privacy. Hey, we're making great progress here. Let's keep it going.
Okay, sorry, I was going to go down another direction with respect to policing, but go ahead. I don't want to distract you.
Yeah, no. Do keep going on the policing one. Let's keep it running.
But
yeah.
I'm sorry. You talk about this stuff, and I come up with different ideas. I guess I'm just trying to do this by way of example of different ways to come at this stuff. So, mm-hmm. Can you imagine if every police force in the world, every radio transmission, you know, all that they had a camera on them, they have a camera in the car, every report they fill out about everything was live transmitted through the web and stored. We have this technical capability and stored on the web. So basically, you got 24/7 surveillance on every police officer in every city in the world. I mean, that's the sort of oversight that we as citizens. If the citizens don't want to ignore it, that's fine. But to be able to give the citizens the power, that's the sort of oversight that we should have. I mean, police. If you're going to police police officer, you should be subscribed to that sort of oversight. It seems only reasonable.
Okay, right. That's a good one to add in there. Let's turn to another area then, which is also to do with large structures of political systems, and that is the whole question of politicians. And I think I mentioned this previously, Stephen, on one of the shows, which is that the political system we have grew up in an era where some guy had to get on a horse and ride to catch a train to take a 2,000-mile journey to represent you somewhere else. But in the internet era, you can represent yourself. The Californian model of citizen participation should be greatly extended, I feel, so that citizens are not relying on politicians to take essential votes, but are actually pushing the buttons on their cell phones or whatever it takes to enable the citizens to participate, not just either in voting, but also in policy development, so that policy development, government policy development, is an open function which takes place on the internet, not as a token gesture, but as a live political reality, so that the will of the people is translated directly into political decision making?
I think, personally, I've got mixed emotions about that. Mm-hmm. I kind of wrestled with that. I'd love to hear other folks' feedback on the forum, but you're kind of talking about a direct democracy approach.
Yeah.
Right now, we've got a problem where we've got a population so uneducated about what's going on, they can easily be psyops into making decisions that are not in their interest. I don't know which way to go there. That'd be an area that I would love to brainstorm online with other folks and see how other folks think. But again, you're absolutely right. The technology is clearly there to give us all that ability. I mean, one of the things, I think it says that I've got a personal homepage or somewhere I put this up where one of the things that I've always wanted to figure out how to do is how do you give your average citizen the ability to meaningfully participate in democracy in less than 10 or 15 minutes a day? I mean, the fact is everybody continues to be busy doing whatever it is they love to do and working and supporting their families, and I don't know how much that's all going to change. But can technology be used such that the information could be provided in such a way that, you know, in the morning while they're having their coffee, they can get the information so they can make that meaningful contribution? I mean, I think you and I were talking on an earlier text conversation. We were talking about our experiences across the United States. You had been here, and we were both agreeing that people of the United States are good people deep down, no matter where you go, moralistic, and generally make good decisions. It's when they're misinformed that they make bad decisions.
Well, yeah, that takes us nicely.
For me, what's most important is how do you disaggregate the flow of information so that they can get, objective flow of information rather than through these given identities on the left and the right that skew everything and try and box us.
Okay, well, that's a good point, and it takes us into the issue of media, because a well-informed public is going to take good decisions, but well-informed means free of vested interests, which are informing them in a certain way that they like. And we have lost control of media. Certainly mainstream media is a corporate structure which is profit-oriented and in the hands of a few. And that's got to be a key area, surely, as well.
And I think until the net got popular, I mean, I've been thinking about that and just in trying to figure out how do you wrestle with this one. I don't know if we can ever unscrew the traditional media that we've got out there. I think it's so wrapped up now. That's a challenge, and I've not been able to see a way to go down that road. Maybe some other folks have some ideas, but thank God we've got this flat network model that really has not been able to be controlled to date. I think what we've got to do is just focus on doing what we're already doing. I mean, RSS feeds are a great way to aggregate content from sites of interest. Having blogs out there, or what really have become citizen journalists, have been majorly impactful. And I think we're kind of already going down that road at a very fast pace. And I think that's going to continue to change things. I don't know how to pull away people away from their television sets until they awaken. With these issues.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind.
That's what I still wrestle with.
Yeah, I don't mind if they watch TV so much as that, there were laws. You know, the idea was that people had concluded it was a bad idea to have media fall into the control of a small group of people, which it has. And those laws have been circumvented. So all I'm saying is let's sort of get those back on the table again and make some use of them. But I don't want to get bogged down in any one particular area. We're talking about full spectrum liberty, and it touches so many areas. But, of course, one of the areas of your life that the issue of liberty touches profoundly is the ability to, in liberty, earn a living wage without undue taxes and in a system which is not oppressive to you as a person. Any ideas on that one, Stephen?
It's a tough one. I mean, I think, obviously, here in the U.S., this whole free trade thing has just been a scam beyond belief, and we're just getting looted faster than you can even count the money going out of the country. Somewhere I read, and maybe one of the listeners knows this better, but there's a quote somewhere where it talks about as you expand the labor force, wages theoretically go to zero, and we're seeing that right now. You know what? I don't know what the answer to that one is. I mean, in the short term, I think putting, you know, potentially putting trade back to the way it was before NAFTA would be considerably helpful for American citizens, but I don't really know what that does to folks in the rest of the globe. Again, I think that'd be a great one to throw out on the forum and see what folks have to think. I can say that the internet certainly has changed e-commerce, but still, you guys just was looking at marketing figures. E-commerce in the U.S. is still only 3% in consumer sales, of total consumer sales.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still, you know, we're still very much in our infancy.
Well, there is certainly one area, and that is the issue of taxes. And one of the reasons that we're in the problem we're in right now is that we haven't managed to hold what was a core value in a group which I don't politically agree with, which is the Republican Party. But the Republican Party used to be the party of small government. It might be worth mentioning here that Margaret Thatcher, for example, was a cheerleader for small government, and yet when she came into office, government spending was 43% of GDP. When she left office after her many years of campaigning, it was 44%. It had gone up. So, but one way or the other, government spending and taxes are directly related, and the tendency for oppressive structures comes out of a lot of funds going into government. So surely that's an area as well, to get down to like 7% taxes, you know. Totally.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, some of the reading I've done and the whole taxation and the whole money supply thing, it's such a complicated area, and I'm still wrestling with it. I've certainly done years of research. You know, it's the one thing I've concluded is the majority of taxation, at least at the federal level here in the U.S., is more of a societal control mechanism than it is a government funding it, you know, necessity. And you go back to a report that Reagan commissioned when he first, you're talking about the Republican Party, he and he first took office with a bunch of private industry folks, and they basically came out and said you can cut government spending by 50% and not affect services, significantly degrade services to the U.S. population.
Yeah.
But that report quickly got buried. So obviously, you know, there is some support historically for significantly cutting the tax base, and clearly this country was never set up to have a big central federal government. I mean, states were supposed to be self-sufficient with a very small federal government. Everything's been turned on its head, and so I think we got to figure out ways to flip it back. And I think government, especially with technology, can be made much more local.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, you want active civic engagement. Well, that's where you're going to get active civic engagement, at the local level. And there's no reason with technology that you can't have a very active citizenry overseeing the public domain in a town.
Yeah, and of course a great tactic is that in any kind of assistance that you're giving to people or programs that the government has, et cetera, don't give them vouchers. Give them the money. Don't give them systems and places they can go to get assistance. Give them the money and let them make the choice as to where they want to get assistance from or whatever. We're not going to come up with all the answers here, but some of the things I would like to do is to take a look at how you would implement this, and maybe touch on a couple of other areas as well, as we go through this discussion. Just touch on some other areas and then also just take a look at how we would actually deliver this and make it work. What I'd like to do, Stephen, if you can hold for a moment, is just play a little music, give ourselves a time to think and listeners a time to think. And let's just pick this up in a moment. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com, and we're discussing the future, full spectrum liberty. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
very welcome back. You're on the next level, and we're discussing Full Spectrum Liberty with Navari, alias Stephen. And Stephen, there was somebody straight in on this issue, Jeff S. As soon as you posted that, he said, here, well spoken. And his suggestion was that the liberty theme should encompass many areas, from the spiritual, the mental, the philosophical, and into sciences, arts, health, and well-being. And yes, it's an all-encompassing thing, and we're going to do no more than just scratch the surfaces of it. But clearly one of the areas it touches upon is the health and welfare of people and how they can express their liberty that way. And once again, that's an area of vital concern. We've been backed into a corner by Big Pharma, and we need to do something about that as well.
Right. I mean, I think, yeah, again, how do we disaggregate these big, you know, are there certain classes of industries that we treat differently, like Big Pharma? Is there a way to disaggregate them so they're more democratically overseen or run? Do they subscribe to a different level of standards with respect to oversight? I mean, I don't know what those issues are, but let me tell you something. I think that if you start to get a segment of the population that starts talking about these issues, start talking about correcting them, I think a lot of people will get very nervous.
Yeah.
And I think that's the immediate next step is just to begin. We don't have answers for this. These are complicated issues. It's going to take discussion. But that's exactly how you implement the change. Just, you've got to start that discussion in each of these areas.
Yeah.
And before the break, you had kind of talked about, you know, how do you implement this? And I think one of the things that you and I talked about earlier, you had actually, you know, when you mentioned the Republican Party and how some of their initial values had been morphed by this newer Republican Party that's in power now, maybe one of the first things that could be done here is what are the core values that underneath Full Spectrum Liberty? What might those be? I think having a discussion, brainstorming those, trying to define Full Spectrum Liberty through a set of core values might be an initial first step. And then all of these issues that you eventually have to discuss and figure out, that can all be done through the looking glass of those initial core values that you lay out. I mean, I think that might be an initial step.
Yeah, we're scratching the surface here and just sort of opening up some ideas. But one of the ones on pharma is we got to find out some way of dealing with the revolving door whereby people move from corporate executive positions in the pharmaceutical industry into institutions like the FDA, where they then oversee the very companies that they just worked for. That's got to end. But hey, here's one that's going to resonate with a lot of people: the money supply. Those dollars and where they come from, and taking back the money supply into the hands of the people and away from the private banking system called the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I mean, I think just having greater discussions on alternative currencies or complementary currencies that people start to use, just having a discussion about a framework which is more along the lines of what President Andrew Jackson implemented in the early 1800s, where the government did control the printing of dollars. I mean, again, just having those sorts of discussions, these are not been in the public domain. We've really been conditioned very well since 1913 that the current banking system is a public banking system, and paying taxes to a federal government is something that you have to do in order to keep the system afloat. It really hasn't been questioned. I think those questions need to be asked, and new visions of setting up a currency model need to be floated, and I think multiple visions for how that would manifest itself need to be floated. I think, again, it just comes down to entering the discussions, showing folks that the government can be run with significantly less revenue, that you personally can have a much better lifestyle. I think those are the sorts of benefits that will interest the common folk out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've covered quite a number of areas there, and I'd like to once again pick up on something that was mentioned by Jeff S. in that post in the forum. And remember, you can click on the image that goes with this audio to start reading and/or contributing to this yourself. But he was saying it came up in relation to the movie The Secret, that one of the important reasons we have to start focusing on this stuff is that unless we do, it's never going to happen. If we're always reactive, reacting to what they, in inverted commas, are doing, then it's a negative approach in the first place, and we are not focusing on something positive, and we're not developing our own ideas. I think that's a very powerful point.
We can win the game of ideas. That's an easy victory. That's a slam dunk. The only way they succeed is by psyoping us and keeping us in the state that we've been in for a number of years. But in the marketplace of ideas, we kick their butt. It's really just a matter of starting a discussion and getting those ideas out there in some cohesive way in which regular folks can understand them.
Yeah. Well, one of the ideas that you were discussing with me in text messages just before we came on air was implementing some kind of a wiki in order to start assembling this full spectrum of liberty and what it might mean.
Right, yeah, so the challenge becomes, okay, so you've got all these esoteric ideas, you know, there's going to be a ton of visions. How do you start to create something that's concrete, that you can get in the hands of people, that they can understand and digest? You know, I go back to 1984. What a brilliant way to do this. Create a fictional novel, which is exciting, which is interesting, and of course had a ton of marketing, you know, support behind it, but which engaged folks. And I think a similar sort of approach could be adopted here. So, you know, step one, once you get your core values down, start taking a look at some of these issues, throw them out there, everybody brainstorm what are the issues you want to target, and see if we can prioritize them. Perhaps using a wiki where folks can sort of collaboratively edit a document. Once you pick, say, the first five, then we can start to attack those. But I think ultimately, looking at the 1984 example, I think if you're going to get something like this in the mainstream, it's almost as if you've got to create a vision for folks that's totally real about what society can look like in 100 years from now. Implant it in their brain, create a fictional model, mm-hmm. create a pretend town, show how average citizens in that pretend town work and interact with others in society and government and how they operate with other, you know, with other towns. Create a vision that is so alive that you start to gain mind share through that vision. And I think that's what 1984 did so successfully. And we just need to replicate that, but to our benefit.
Turn it around. Yeah, well, there's so many innovative technologies and ways of people...
All to our benefit.
Mm-hmm. For example, there's a system called Second Life. You can check that out, secondlife.com, where people are living a virtual world right now on the internet. And... with a combination of those technologies, I think it is possible to start to build a vision. And the thing is that if you build a vision, well, then you've got something to take to the people. Then people start to coalesce around that vision, and you've got a chance of making that then a political platform, which you can start banging down the doors of the existing political structure or whoever to start to get that onto the agenda. But merely starting to talk about it makes it, hey, this is the way things work, isn't it, Stephen? If you start to talk about them, then they're going to start happening. If you've got an idea for a new company, nothing's going to happen until you start talking to your friends about it, and maybe you start getting some ideas together, and hey, before you know it, you're starting up a new business. It's the same with this.
You gotta create the vision so other folks who aren't as far along as you are, and we've got some people that are very far along, but I think can mm-hmm. do this in this group that you've created and online, this community, who can help create a vision that's clear and would be extremely appealing to folks that haven't gone through this awakening process.
Yeah, well, it's...
I think that's our challenge.
Yeah, it is a bit of a challenge, because they have so psyoped people that I think people are on the defensive a great deal, and so that's what I felt was very powerful about this approach, was that it was getting us back into a positive frame of mind. And because it touches on so many areas of people's lives, that it needs some kind of a technological approach that enables people to discuss and deal with all of these different areas, because we're so deep in this hole that we need to tackle it on many fronts at the same time. And we need a guerrilla army of ideas in order to do so. And we can do it online. We can do it using the very internet, which is a great symbol of liberty itself.
I couldn't agree more, but I think the one thing is it can quickly become really daunting. So I think it's a matter of, you know, folks deciding whether they want to do this and then trying to pick off the top top few that they want to target, and just start chipping away at the rock pile.
Okay, right.
I think we gotta begin somewhere, and it's a big rock pile that we gotta break down.
Okay, got to start somewhere. We've made a start. You've made a start. You've planted a seed there. A very powerful concept, full spectrum liberty. And we've outlined some of the potentials there, but I wouldn't like that to restrict anybody. And another great idea that you had about this was that we could also follow up the discussion we've had with our limited brains, only two minds working on this, with a collective discussion and using Skype, maybe sometime next week. That's a great idea for a collaborative discussion online, yeah.
Skype, I just downloaded the latest version of Skype for Windows, version 3, this last week, and I noticed something new. They seem to have a public chat area where it would allow you, Fintan, to basically open up a line. And any one of us, I think you can restrict who can call in, but any one of us can call in, and you can end up with basically a chat room. Anyone can call in whenever they want. Just say you open up the chat room for 2 hours, and anyone can call in whenever they want and join in the discussion. So it might be an interesting way to have a voice brainstorming session if folks have downloaded and installed Skype and have high bandwidth connections.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and we'll look into that and see exactly how it would operate. If you'd like to participate in that, I think it would be only fair that it would be restricted to those who have made some kind of a contribution in the topic thread in the Thinking Zone, which Steve has kicked off. And if you want to participate in that, then just get stuck in there, and those who participate, we can have a huge number of people involved. We'll see what the technology allows, but we will have some kind of like this, except with more than just two minds working on the issue, and do some more brainstorming towards the end of next week. And I'm looking forward to that, Steve. I'm looking forward to discussion in the meantime in the forum as people would contribute to this idea of full spectrum liberty. And I'd like to thank you very much for bringing the thing up, and I'd like to thank you also for joining me here on The Next Level tonight.
You're very welcome, and thank you for doing what you do.
Okay, well, let's see what we can do together. I'm going to be right back in just a moment with Dr. Al Sears on a completely different topic area, but a very important one as well. He's got some great and innovative ideas, and they're just as innovative as what you heard from Steve. In the meantime, we'll take a track from Badmarsh and Shree, and this is Signs. You're on The Next Level on breakfornews.com, and we'll be right back.
Life is one big road with a lot of signs. Signs and more signs. You gotta make up your mind, your mind, your mind. Life is one big road with a lot of signs. Signs and more signs. You gotta make up your mind. Life is one big road, road. Signs and more signs. You gotta make up your mind to face reality. Oh.
And you're very welcome back. You're on the next level on breakfornews.com. And we are going straight from the west coast of the US to the east coast to speak to Dr. Al Sears. And you can check his website out while you're listening to this. It's Al Sears, ALSEARSMD.com. And Al Sears is a leading authority on longevity and heart health. And he is also board certified in anti-aging medicine. He's an adjunct professor at Barry University, and he's an ACE certified fitness trainer. So a guy with a lot of smarts in the area of exercise, and he's got some insights on exercise. You remember when that leading jogger keeled over and died, and everybody suddenly realized that, hey, jogging maybe wasn't the best way to go about fitness. He's been looking into that, and he has some terrific ideas on what caused that and why, in fact, exercising in the wrong way, the kind of, you know, feel the burn kind of over-exercise, can be the wrong thing to do, and how a very simple and straightforward technique can actually improve your health terrifically without wearing you out. And he's joining us on the line right now from Florida. You're very welcome to the next level, Dr. Sears. We came across each other through that other website, I'm involved in mylonglife.com, and I'm very glad we did. And what I was just talking about there, Al, you are the only person, to my knowledge, that has actually come to a deeper understanding of what it is that's going on there and how the wrong kind of exercise can actually weaken the heart and can actually negatively affect us.
I think, you know, there is the runner's syndrome that, you know, that people have observed that runners sometimes tend to drop dead what they thought was the peak of good health. There's something wrong with that picture. And then you have several groups of athletes that have figured it out and decided not to do durational cardio.
Yes.
You know, there are many bodybuilders who won't touch cardio. Because they say, you know, they can't do it without losing muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
And some that are really exceptionally lean. I've seen bodybuilders at 3.5% body fat that haven't done any cardio in 8 years. And then you have this kind of a conception that look at long-distance runners, you know, that's not my idea of health, so, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing that if that's the crystallization of that process. But I don't think anyone has ever actually put it together to say that cardio is bad for your cardiopulmonary capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, you know, I'll just not worry about my heart. I know cardio would make my heart healthier, but I don't want to do it because I don't want, you know, injured knees and a decrepit, stooped posture and you know, the look of stress on my face that I see in those long-distance runners. So they've avoided it, thinking they were sacrificing heart health in doing it, when I think I'm the first person to say that's not only not true, but those people who do durational cardio have lower heart health than those that do other kinds of exercise.
And the body will respond to the kind of exercise protocols that we're engaging in and make an adaptive response to that.
Bingo.
Yeah. So.
And that's what, you know, it's conventional medicine doesn't deal with that very well.
Mm-hmm.
They continually come to that conclusion that nature is ignorant. God made mistakes, that we are, you know, diseased because we are made wrong and they have to fix it. That they're smarter than nature and they can intervene like a broken car. You're going to beat that part straight with a hammer. When healing and health improvement is so fundamentally different, because your body has its innate healing system. It's adaptable and it responds to what you do. So if you treat it like it's an ignorant mistake, then it tends to, you know, notice your intervention and try to respond to negate it, which is, you know, what we see with medications. What we see with so many errors in exercise programs is that there's an unnatural stress put on the body, and the body tries to negate that effect. For instance, many people are surprised to learn that if you exercise at a low level so that you're maximizing fat burning during the exertion, your body will say, well, it's a good thing that I had that much fat, because that was the only way I could fuel that activity for that long, because it's long before that ran out of glycogen and ATP and creatine. So what is it going to do? It's going to build more fat as soon as you eat. Now,
right.
As long as you're doing that recurrently, you won't have an increase in adipose tissue because you will be burning it. But as soon as you stop, you've now converted your metabolism to be a fat-burning machine. And that's why so many people will start to have a little bit of a problem with leanness. So they enter a running program and reverse it, be happy with it, but then something happens, and it almost inevitably does, where they can't continue the same length and frequency of cardio endurance. Then they gain weight back far in excess of where they started. Now they have a lower lean body mass and they've got a much greater percentage body fat than before they did any exercise.
Right, so they've dug themselves into a hole.
Yes.
What is the body thinking when you're engaging in that, and
yes.
why does it reduce the heart?
Downsizing the heart, what's more problematic than shrinking the muscle is shrinking the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that just like your skeletal muscle decreases in mass with durational cardio, your heart muscle is decreasing in mass too. But there may be some benefit to that with, you know, thinner heart being easier to supply oxygen to. So it's hard to focus on the decrease in muscle mass of the heart in itself as being dangerous because we don't really know. But we do know that decreasing your cardiac output, decreasing your stroke volume, and decreasing your maximal cardiac output with exercise does occur, and that those things are dangerous. So what happens is, just like you can document a loss of skeletal muscle capacity,
mm-hmm.
that strength goes down with durational exertion, you can document that cardiac output, maximal cardiac output, goes down with durational exertion for exactly the same reason. Your body strives for efficiency in that durational effort. If you're jogging for, you know, 40 minutes a day, your body's going to try to burn less energy during those 40 minutes. There are problems for that kind of duration that your body has to deal with. How is it going to supply the energy you need for that? How is it going to get rid of the waste products? And then prepare yourself to do that better next time. It's more efficient to drive a Volkswagen at 30 miles an hour than it is to drive a Ferrari at 30 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not using the capacity, but you're using a duration, your body will seek efficiency.
I thought that one of the most stunning pieces of observational science was an illustration you used to bring these points home when you came in contact with the sheer strength of a chimpanzee. And you're starting to figure to yourself, how is it this little guy is so strong? And the secret of it being that he's engaging in burst activity, which is training his body in a particular way and building incredible strength. Chimpanzees tend to engage in these sudden, highly active bursts, and then they stop again.
As do most animals.
Mm-hmm.
We are different in that we tend to push ourselves at a moderate level of exertion for prolonged periods. And you know, there's no animal that really does it exactly like that we do with running. I mean, we wouldn't have done that in a native environment. And I think that's another, you know, kind of an observational deduction to make, that when you look at native hunter-gatherers that have survived into modern times,
mm-hmm.
you find that they spend a lot of time lounging, a surprising amount of time. When I was in the Amazon with the Ashanika, they laid in hammocks for most of the day. They would go hunting about every 3 or 4 days, and even during the hunts, it was mostly a leisurely walk.
Right.
They would you know, maybe run for 2 minutes during, you know, a 3 or 4 day period.
Well, that's another aspect of what you've brought out, is the importance of rest as well as exercise, and combining the two in the right way.
Because all of the benefit comes during the rest. All you have to do during the exercise is key in the adaptive response. So if what you're trying to do is you're trying to improve your maximal heart rate, you really just only have to give your heart rate a bit of a challenge, you know, exceed your current capacity to supply oxygen.
Right.
And create a bit of an oxygen debt, which you can measure in your exercise program by simply checking your heart rate. If, you know, you do an exertion set for, say, a minute, and your heart rate goes from, you know, a baseline of 100 to 135, but then after you stop, it rises for the next 15 seconds and peaks out to 144, you can measure the amount of the oxygen debt that you created. You exerted yourself at a rate higher than you could supply oxygen for, and your heart is then increasing its rate while you rest because you create an oxygen debt. Then you pat yourself on the back and say you did the right thing, and you could theoretically go hit the shower then. Mm-hmm. You really only need to do that once to induce that adaptive response, which is, I think, some confusion with the PACE program. Many think of this as an interval training program or the same thing as interval. There's two major reasons this is different.
Mm-hmm.
One, you really don't have to do any intervals. You can do it one time. You can have one set. And as long as you follow those principles of challenging your cardiopulmonary capacity or creating an oxygen debt, you will make the adaptive response when you're resting. And then the other thing that's different is we focus on the progressive incremental changes that you don't read about in interval training programs. They generally don't talk about that, but that's the most important point. You can't just take somebody and tell them to train intervals and expect them to have a progression of their maximal cardiopulmonary output and their lung volume. To do that, you have to train to your current level of fitness, exert yourself in a brief episode of cardiopulmonary challenge,
mm-hmm.
and then do it a little bit more in your next session. All exercise programs only work if they have a progressive element. Otherwise, you make an adaptive response for a couple of weeks, and then you're done. If you want to change your body, you got to continue to change the program. And what makes this unique, that I don't think anyone has ever said, is that, first of all, it identifies that you have to have a progressive changing element. But secondly, it says that progressive changing element needs to be some measure of cardiopulmonary challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Heart attacks occur because there's a sudden increase in demand that exceeds your current capacity. So what you do is you train for a greater capacity, but then you also train the adaptive response, the quickness of access to that greater capacity. So by doing that incrementally through time, the end result is that you have a great cardiac and pulmonary capacity that is instantaneously available on demand. That's the native situation. That's what we see in animals. That's what we lack in the modern world. And that's exactly what protects you from a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. We have the idea of feeling the pain. You know, if it's not painful, you're not getting anywhere. And that really is, it's a cultural idea.
What exercise should be about is feel the joy.
Right.
It's a delight, you know, absolutely delight in the exertion. And, you know, it gets more and more fun the more you do it. It's like a celebration.
Yes.
It feels more like dancing or partying or laughing than it does like working. You restore that thing you had as a child that would sometimes make you light out the door and just burst into a speed of wind sprint of just running as fast as you could or jumping or flinging your arms in the air. You actually feel that energy again. It's another benefit of the program. When you train that high energy output system to be more immediately available on demand, you feel, you have a perceived increased sense of energy available. You feel more energetic. The biggest complaint I get about being old, they just wish they had the energy they had when they were younger. And we've accepted it as aging when it's mostly deconditioning.
Right.
And then we tell them, well, you need to get out and exercise, but we tell them an exercise program that only makes it worse.
And what you were speaking there about that natural joy of exercise, I do remember on one particular occasion after not very heavy exertion in Taekwondo, which I was doing, and coming out on the street and just for the heck of it, running, and experiencing this almost gliding effect where there didn't actually seem to be exertion. I was just running, not even seeming to touch the ground. And that,
it's natural. You know, we are born with that instinct. And
mm-hmm.
running, you know, really is the most natural exercise there is, the most natural cardiopulmonary challenge there is. you can substitute lots of other things, but that is the native heart and lung conditioner.
Right, so the core issues then is a sequence of challenges, but moderate and accelerating.
You can tell somebody to start off easy and incrementally increase the challenge as it becomes easier for them, and specifically, do not extend the duration, and it doesn't take much of your time, and it's not drudgery, and it doesn't take very long. We have, you know, hundreds of people, maybe 1,000 now, that's gone through this program, and one of the surprising responses we hear all the time is, I can't believe how much different I feel in only 2 weeks.
And how do you see, are there any key elements in diet? In the interviews we've already done on My Long Life, we focused on the issue of wheat. We're looking at the issue of lectins, and these seem to be two critical areas. So dairy, many people are already aware of. Wheat,
yes. The
silent killer, they're not really aware of that. And
you know, our governments that tend to encourage that. You know, you hear that term, low glycemic grains, healthy whole grains, all the time.
Yes.
As far as I can tell, there are no low glycemic grains, and there are no healthy grains.
Yeah.
Whether they are whole or not. Grains are a big part of the problem. It was the beginning of the greatest epidemic of disease the world has ever known, and it has worsened century by century and decade by decade, till now it dwarfs every other human malady.
Yeah.
It has surpassed even infectious disease, that constellation of diseases of obesity, heart disease, and diabetes.
Yeah.
And it comes from, you know, we can certainly prove that, or at least give almost irrefutable circumstantial evidence that this has to be an environmental factor, because we can see, you know, a rapid change through time and an acceleration that, you know, genes can't change that fast, and then we can show it in different populations and show that when you move from one population to the next, your risk of this constellation of chronic disease assumes that of the new population in a single generation. All that evidence says, you know, it's something we did to the environment.
Yeah.
And lots of evidence suggests that it is a dietary change, similar kinds of demographic and population evidence. So you got to look at how we change the diet, and how we change the diet, one thing really sticks out, doesn't it? We converted from a hunter-gatherer diet to an agrarian diet, and bingo, that's when all these diseases began. And then we very much worsened that with the processing of those grains.
Yes.
That now we have this accelerated change towards more and more unnatural substitute food. So I agree with what you said, you know, the wheat itself, the gluten, the lectins, the dairy. But I paint that all against the background that those things are unhealthy because they're unnatural. Just like a plant that grows in its native soil is optimally healthy and you don't have to do anything to it. You take a plant that is native to South Africa and you plant it in South Florida. Now you've got to worry about how much sun it gets, how much rainfall, the seasonal variations, the consistency of the soil, the nutrients in the soil, the various minerals, and it becomes an extremely involved scientific endeavor to try to make that thing grow healthy, and we've never really exactly perfected it, even with something as simple as a grass or a palm tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taking something as complex as a mammal and take it completely out of its native environment and create a new one for it, what's the chances that you're going to hit that right?
Well, it's been very informative to take just a brief look at the kind of work you're doing, Al, and I do hope you'll join us again.
You let us know, and I'll make myself available. Nice talking with you today.
Okay. Thanks for taking the time, Al, to talk to us.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care now. Bye-bye. Okay, well, there you go. That's an education. And I hope you take that to heart. Remember, what his advice is to use progressive exercise, which doesn't overstress you, which is not of long duration, and you can achieve the health benefits you're looking for without wearing yourself out and negatively affecting yourself. More at Al Sears, MD. And that's about it for this edition of The Next Level. I will be back. Next week's going to be an interesting week. on breakfornews.com. We've been doing shows towards the end of the week to give people weekend listening, but we'll be back early next week with some shows I think you'll find interesting. You could even say we're going to the next level from next week as 2007 really kicks in. Meanwhile, I hope you will contribute in the full spectrum liberty topic in the forum. And of course, towards the end of next week, we'll have some kind of a group phone-in for those who have contributed in that topic thread. We'll see if we can bring some more focus and get some more brainstorming done on the idea of full spectrum liberty. So I'm looking forward to that towards the end of the week. But join us towards the beginning of the week for something special. I'll be back with that. I do hope you can take time to join us for it. But in the meantime, for Break for News, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting.
Will you always keep me warm? Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Will you always keep me warm? Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Walking into the sun.